to start our call-in and introduce our presenter for tonight, Dr. Shirley Yen. Shirley is a true clinical researcher. She is currently an associate professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the Alpert Brown Medical School at Brown University. She completed her PhD and clinical research training in clinical psychology at Duke University, and she's been an NIMH-funded investigator for the past 15 years. She conducts research on suicidal behavior, so work that's very, very important to our focus on NEABPD, and in particular, our GAP focus is evident in her work, which seeks to identify risk factors and to develop interventions for suicidal behaviors in adolescents as well as adults. So tonight, we have the pleasure of hearing about her work that examines suicidal and self-injurious behaviors in youth with borderline personality disorder features. Welcome, Shirley. Go ahead and please start your talk.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to this call-in series. So today I'll be discussing suicidal and self-injurious behavior in youth with borderline personality disorder features. So let's go get started and go to slide two. Now, there have been surprisingly few studies of suicidal behavior in adolescents with BPD, and this is surprising because suicide is the second leading cause of death in the U.S. in the 15 to 24 age group, and the suicide rate in this age cohort has been fairly stable in the past several decades, and that's despite the number of psychosocial interventions and pharmacotherapies that have been developed to target depression. And if anything, there's been a slight uptick in recent years in the suicide rate, particularly in adolescent girls. Also, the rate of suicidal behaviors is also alarmingly high in adolescents. According to the Risk Youth Behaviors Risk Survey, nearly 18% of U.S. high school students seriously considered suicide. Nearly 9% reported making a suicide attempt, and almost 2.5% made an attempt that required medical intervention in the preceding 12 months. So these statistics, in combination with the fact that there's a very robust body of literature which suggests that BPD is strongly associated with increased risk for suicidal behavior in adults, suggest that it's important to look at BPD in adolescents, yet many studies that examine adolescent suicidality often don't assess for BPD. So next slide. So why might this be? Well, diagnosing a personality disorder in childhood or adolescence remains controversial and for some legitimate reasons. PDs are rarely assessed or diagnosed in children and adolescents in clinical practice, and this is partly because of the stigma associated with BPD and with the presumption that it's a lifelong disorder, even though several longitudinal studies have found that PDs are actually very likely to remit. There may be some functional impairment that remains, but overall the prognostic outcome is actually positive. Another reason for the reluctance to diagnose PDs in adolescence is that personality is presumed to be forming during adolescence, and many PD traits reflect behaviors or identities that are not fully developed until adulthood. So, for example, we know from neuroimaging studies that the frontal cortical area, the brain that's primarily responsible for impulse control, continues to develop into our early 20s. And we also know that identity disturbance is not uncommon in adolescents. So next slide, please. However, there's some important counterpoints to this as well. One is that it's often reported to us from adults with personality disorders that many of the dysfunctional behaviors that underlie BPD began during adolescence. So I began my career working with adults, and having heard this so many times, I actually became interested in working with adolescents and switched my career focus. Another counterpoint is that temperament and personality traits that underlie PDs are relatively stable. So while not everyone with impulsivity will go on to develop antisocial or borderline personality disorder, it would be very unusual to find someone with these disorders that did not exhibit impulsivity or impulse control problems during their childhood. There's also a growing body of research which suggests that BPD can be reliably and validly diagnosed in adolescents. So I've done some of this work, as well as Carla Sharp and Andrew Chanin and others. And finally, the most important reason is that we know that early diagnosis leads to early intervention with the appropriate empirically supported treatments, of which there are several, with DBT being the most notable. Okay, next slide, please.
So this myth, Shirley, this idea, this myth that you're not able to diagnose BPD or any personality disorder in adolescence is something that is already has and will come a lot in this year's call-in series. And here you've told us about an important consequence of not diagnosing BPD in teens, that mm-hmm. this has affected our research, and we have little knowledge now about the link between BPD and suicide in adolescence. So could you tell us a little bit more about this controversy and whether it's changed in recent years, any factors that may have led to this change?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's an excellent question. So I think that with regard to whether it's changing, I do believe that the tide is changing, that we have a far ways to go. A few factors that might be contributing to the change. One is the dissemination of research, which shows that personality disorders are not necessarily lifelong, as initially conceptualized. The second is, I think ironically, there's been some backlash to the fact that for a while, many adolescents were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and that actually, that increase in prevalence of pediatric bipolar has come under scrutiny. It's actually received some media attention, and subsequently some studies have found that actually a lot of people who have been diagnosed by the clinicians as having bipolar disorder don't meet for bipolar disorder when you give them a structured diagnostic interview, but they do meet criteria for borderline personality disorder. And so I think that backlash, has helped shift our thinking as well. And I do think another helpful factor is the proliferation of DBT clinics and programs for adolescents. So I think that all those factors contribute to clinicians being a little bit more willing and parents being more willing to consider this diagnosis in adolescents.
Well, these are great points. Thanks for bringing them up to put your work in historical perspective. That's great.
Oh, sure. Okay, so to slide number 5. So what do we know based on the relatively small body of research out there? Well, we know that in adolescent inpatients, BPD confers incremental risk above major depressive disorder and substance use disorder, which are two other disorders that have been associated with suicide risk. In one study, Carla Sharp and her colleagues found this to be the case for suicide ideation and deliberate self-harm, but not for suicide attempts. And that study controlled for MDD. And then another study in which investigators looked at suicide risk, which is a composite of ideation behavior, so it wasn't really possible to disentangle the two, they found that BPD was associated with higher risk after accounting for depression and substance abuse symptoms. Now let's go on to the next slide, slide 6. We also know that suicide ideation has a strong relationship to suicide attempt history, particularly in those who engage in non-suicidal self-injury behavior, or what I'll call NSSI. In one cross-sectional study of a sample that included people from the community as well as patients, Klonsky and his colleagues found that NSSI and suicide ideation were significantly associated with suicide attempts, but BPD was not. In another study, the Pittsburgh Girls study, which was prospective in nature, girls with both NSSI and suicide ideation were significantly more likely to report lifetime and recent suicide attempts. And this was the case for the entire sample, regardless of BPD status. And also a study of great interest to me is a recent one that looked at the developmental trajectories of self-injurious behaviors, suicide behaviors, and substance misuse, and found a high degree of overlap in these trajectories, which in itself is not surprising, but the overlapping high-risk classes show an exceptionally high score on BPD criteria. So how do we make sense of this set of research, which seems to suggest that BPD certainly confers risk for a number of high-risk behaviors related to suicide, but that its actual association with suicide attempts is rather inconsistent? Next slide, please. One model that might help us make sense of this set of findings is Thomas Joyner's interpersonal psychological theory of suicide, which suggests that three factors, thwarted belongingness, perceived burdensomeness, and acquired capacity for self-harm, set forth the condition for suicide. And it's this latter factor that I want to draw your attention to, the acquired capacity for self-harm. It's possible that during adolescence, what we're observing is that BPD adolescents are indeed acquiring this capacity for self-harm through their management, through their engagement in suicide ideation, self-injurious behaviors, and substance use, and that this acquired capacity then translates into an increased risk for suicide attempts and suicide in adulthood. So it's all the more important that we intervene early to interrupt the cycle. Move on to the next slide, number 9. So to further our understanding of BPD and suicidality in adolescents, I conducted a study in which we recruited adolescents who were hospitalized on an inpatient psychiatric unit due to suicide risk and followed them for 6 months post-discharge. And the 6 months after discharge is a very high-risk period of time. And the goal was to identify prospective predictors of recurrent suicidal behavior. And some of the questions we asked were, you know, what's the prevalence rate of BPD in a sample of consecutively admitted adolescents who were admitted for suicide risk? And how does this compare to other disorders? And how do those with and without BPD compare on clinical characteristics? Are there differences in suicidal behavior and NSSI between those with and without BPD? What about the pattern of suicide ideation in adolescents with BPD? Does BPD affect suicide ideation intensity and lability? And which suicide ideation profile, high intensity or high lability, is associated with a higher risk for suicidal behavior over 6 months of follow-up? So in some of my patients, I've observed that there are some with chronic high levels of suicide ideation, while others may have more fluctuating patterns that are more reactive to stressful life events. So I think it's important to understand each of these patterns and the risk for future self-harm. And finally, does perceived emotional validation from family and peers predict suicidal behaviors and NSSI? Move on to the next slide, please. So I'm going to go over the methods rather quickly, as I like to spend more of our time discussing the results and clinical implications. Our participants were recruited from the inpatient unit. They were hospitalized due to suicide risk. There were no diagnostic exclusions. Patients were only ruled out if they had a cognitive impairment that precluded them from completing the assessment battery or if they were non-English speaking. And we recruited 118 adolescents, 99 of whom provided the full 6 months of follow-up data. Next slide. And we used a number of diagnostic interviews. The KSATs was used to assess for Axis I disorders, history of suicidal behaviors, and childhood abuse. And the CIBPD was used to assess for borderline personality disorder. And we adapted the longitudinal interval follow-up evaluation, or the LIFE, which uses a timeline follow-back methodology to assign weekly ratings for a number of constructs that were of interest of us. And this approach allowed us to look at the course of symptomatology.
Shirley, were the interviews done with just the teens, or did you also do them with the parents?
Well, we did them with both, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, but we did do them with both, most interviews, and we did use consensus ratings.
Great.
So on slide 12, these are some self-reports that we administered. I'll just skip over the details in the interest of time, but wanted to have these here for your reference. On slide 13, separate baseline assessments with adolescents and parents were conducted during the hospital stay or shortly after discharge. And as I mentioned, consensus ratings were done in team meetings, and those ratings were analyzed. Phone calls were made at 2 and 4 months post-discharge to assess for significant life events, the psychiatric status on disorders for which they met criteria baseline, psychosocial functioning, relationship with friends and family, BPD criteria, and suicidal behavior. And in 6 months, we conducted a comprehensive assessment in which weekly and monthly ratings were made for diagnostic status, BPD criteria functioning, and other constructs of interest. Let's go on to the next slide, slide 14. So first set of questions. What's the prevalence of BPD in our high-risk sample? How does it compare to other disorders? What are the clinical characteristics that differentiate those with and without BPD? And how does BPD in suicidal adolescents compare to BPD in a sample of suicidal adults? So next slide, slide 15. So we found that approximately 40% of our sample met criteria for BPD, and the only demographic difference that emerged was for sex. Now, our rate of BPD in suicidal adolescents is quite comparable to the rate reported in another adult study of suicide attempters that recruited from the emergency room. We saw that there were four times more girls were diagnosed than boys, and this gender difference is also relatively consistent with adult studies. With regard to other disorders, only major depressive disorder was diagnosed at a higher rate than BPD. And remember, this is an inpatient sample of suicidal adolescents, so that very high prevalence rate is not very surprising. Other highly prevalent disorders include generalized anxiety disorder, attention deficit disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and conduct disorder. So on to the next slide. And when we compared those with and without BPD, not surprisingly, adolescents who met criteria for BPD were also more likely to be diagnosed with bipolar disorder, conduct disorder, ADHD, and PTSD. And again, this is quite consistent with what we might observe in adults. Go on to the next slide. And we also administer the NEAL 5-factor inventory, which is a personality assessment, a self-report, that assesses broad and specific personality traits. And we found that only neuroticism per the parent report was significantly higher in adolescents with BPD. And we did not find that any other personality traits were significantly different between those with and without BPD. Move on to the next slide. With regard to family functioning, there were no significant differences on family functioning between those with and without BPD. But interestingly, there were some significant discrepancies between how adolescents reported their family functioning and how parents reported their family functioning. Now, this was not specific to BPD. We found this in a sample overall, that parents and adolescents don't necessarily view their family functioning the same way. And one other difference is that adolescents with BPD reported significantly worse relationship with their mothers than those without BPD. Move on to the next slide. Now, with regard to affective dysregulation, we actually didn't find many differences between the groups. We did find that on the emotion regulation checklist, inappropriate affective dysregulation was higher in adolescents with BPD, but there were no differences on other subscales, which indicates that the entire sample, with or without BPD, scored fairly high on affective dysregulation. Next slide. So on slide 20, we see that where we did find differences was in behavioral dysregulation. And so these are the subscales of the aggression questionnaire, and you can see that adolescents with borderline personality disorder scored significantly higher on physical aggression, verbal aggression, anger, and indirect aggression. So here's where we start to see the differentiation between the groups. Next slide. Now, to get a sense of how BPD in adolescents compares with BPD in adults, we compare the percent of the adolescent sample who met each BPD criteria with those of an adult subsample from the CLIPS who also met criteria for BPD and endorsed suicidal behavior. So we see similarities in the proportion of responses for anger and affective instability. But adults were more likely to report fears of abandonment, and this might be because they're more likely to be living alone or to be socially isolated compared to adolescents. Move on to the next slide. Now, endorsement of impulsivity was nearly identical, but adolescents reported self-injurious behaviors at a much higher rate, which, again, is consistent with what we know about deliberate self-harm in NSSI, which is that some of these behaviors do diminish over time. Next slide. And with regard to relationship disturbance, we see very comparable rates of endorsement for unstable relationships, but greater disparity on the other criteria of identity disturbance, emptiness and dissociation and paranoid ideation. And there could be several explanations for this, but some of these criteria, particularly identity disturbance, are considered somewhat normative in adolescence. So when they're rated against the standard of their peers, many may not see the extent of their experiences as being atypical. Now let's move on to the next slide. So to summarize this first set of questions and findings, we found that BPD is highly prevalent among adolescents hospitalized due to suicide risk, more so than any other disorder except for major depressive disorder. And the significant comorbidities include conduct disorder, ODD, bipolar, and PTSD. And the most notable difference between suicidal adolescents with and without BPD was that those with BPD scored much higher on multiple domains of behavioral dysregulation and aggression. But there were few differences in affective dysregulation, which may be more omnipresent in suicidal adolescents in general. We found that BPD in adults and adolescents are comparable across affective and behavioral criteria, except for the self-injurious behaviors criterion. But they differ more broadly on criteria related to relationship disturbance.
So going back up to your first summary comment, Shirley, that we saw this high overlap with depression and BPD. I'm wondering if you could kind of take a step back from your data, get very general here, and just tell us about similarities and differences in the experience of borderline personality disorder and major depression, and how these similarities and differences may relate to suicide in teens.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, one thing I should mention first is that we should keep in mind the difference in prevalence rates. So many folks with borderline personality disorders do meet for comorbid depression. So in BPD, the clinical presentation is more often a mixed picture of comorbidity, whereas whereas major depression is highly prevalent in our society, so that most people with MDD don't have comorbid BPD. But if you're talking about sort of the pure clinical presentations, I mean, based on my research and what I've observed clinically, I think that what feels a little different is in that the MDD adolescent, the predominant feature is this dysphoric mood that seems very deeply entrenched. There's a certain sense of hopelessness and very high and just negative affect. And it's not necessarily reactive. It's just a very depressed feeling. They're not likely to necessarily to be impulsive or to engage in, you know, impulsive behaviors. But, you know, they're at high risk simply by virtue of their hopelessness and depressed mood. Whereas I think the prototypic clinical picture in those with borderline personality disorder, with or without the depression comorbidity, I think you have a couple of things going on, that there is the affective presentation, which can appear as the same type of dysphoric mood or can be more reactive. But I think what we have going on as well is the behavioral dysregulation part, so that they tend to engage in more impulsive behaviors. And so I think that's kind of what my data shows, and that matches the clinical observations I've had in working with this population.
That's really helpful.
Does that answer your question?
Thoughts? Yeah, absolutely. It's helpful to hear your thoughts on differences in the clinical presentations of BPD and MDD. Now I'm wondering about treatment implications. So would you have different recommendations for treatment for a teen who's suicidal and has major depression relative, you know, and how would that differ compared to a teen who's suicidal and has depression and BPD?
Well, I think that when you have BPD in the mix in an adolescent, then I think one of the treatment focus has to be on coping strategies, more effective coping strategies, and tolerating difficult emotions. So so that they don't engage in more self-destructive ways of managing their affect. Whereas I think that in those who are depressed, who don't necessarily exhibit that the impulse control challenges, mm-hmm. then I think that that requires a different approach. So that might mean, for example, an acceptance-based strategy of tolerating difficult affect, but understanding that these feelings come and go, and depression is also episodic. I think that another approach, which is some of my current research, is to work on positive affect skills, because I think that in the depressed youth, they have a tendency towards rumination. And so how do we disrupt that cycle of rumination? And some of the skills I use are increasing, actual exercises to increase their attention to the positive experiences mm-hmm. that they might otherwise discount because they're mm-hmm. depressed.
Mm. Great, thanks.
Okay. So moving on to slide 25. So do the characteristics of suicidal behavior in adolescents with or without BPD differ? Does BPD predict increased risk of suicide events in the 6 months of follow-up? Let's go to slide 26. First, looking at the suicidal behavior reported at baseline, we wanted to examine the precipitating behavior that led to their admission. So were they brought to the hospital because they made a suicide attempt, had suicide ideation, or did they make threats or write a suicide note? We found that adolescents with BPD were much more likely to have been admitted because they made a suicide attempt. It was 46% versus 26%, which was statistically significant. Also, those who met criteria for BPD were more likely to have a past history of suicide attempts, and there were no significant differences in the level of intent to die or medical lethality between adolescents with and without BPD. And this is an important point because it counters some past stereotypes of suicide attempts of BPD individuals as being less severe and more attention-seeking and possibly more manipulative. Now, we did not find this to be the case in our sample. Next slide. So there were no significant differences between those with and without BPD with regard to the rate of NSSI, the frequency of NSSI, or the proportion seeking medical treatment for NSSI, nor on the functions of self-injury. This is somewhat consistent with studies that find that NSSI is not specific to BPD. In fact, many who engage in NSSI do not meet criteria for BPD. Next slide. When we look at suicidal behaviors over the 6 months of follow-up, we find that 24% of those with BPD made a suicide attempt during follow-up, compared to 15% of those who did not meet criteria for BPD. And nearly half of those with BPD reported a suicide event, which we defined as either a suicide attempt or an emergency intervention, such as inpatient admission to intercede a suicide attempt. And this is compared to almost 30% of those without BPD. Well, this difference was close to being statistically significant. On the other hand, suicide ideation and NSSI, though higher in those with BPD, was not significantly different between the groups. Go on to the next slide, number 29. So with regard to treatment during follow-up, we found that adolescents with BPD were more likely to utilize more emergency and intensive forms of treatment, such as ER visits, psychiatric hospitalizations, residential treatments, partial day programs, but there were no differences in outpatient treatment. Look at the next slide. So to summarize this set of results, first, BPD participants were more likely to have made an attempt prior to hospitalization. They're more likely to have had a history of suicide attempts, and their past attempts did not differ from those without BPD on level of intent or medical threat. However, there were no differences on NSSI or functions of NSSI. And Also, BPD participants appear to be more likely to attempt suicide and to receive treatment in intensive settings during follow-up. However, these differences, while they were notable and close to being statistically significant, didn't actually reach that level of statistical significance, possibly due to this relatively small number of events observed during follow-up. Let's go on to the next slide, slide 31, which describes our next set of questions. So we know that affective reactivity is a core component of BPD. And so the question is, well, does this reactivity extend to suicidal ideation as well? Is suicidal ideation in BPD reactive with multiple fluctuations, or is it more chronically severe? And which presentation is associated with a higher risk for suicidal behavior? Next slide, 32. So a better understanding of the parameters of suicidal ideation is important because suicidal ideation is a predictor of subsequent suicidal behavior, as we've covered. And it's also a core central aspect of a suicide risk assessment. So in any good suicide risk assessment, a clinician will ask patients about thoughts of death, thoughts of suicide, or hurting oneself. However, most studies of suicide ideation rely on single administration self-report assessments, which capture a specific time interval but may not adequately capture variability within that time interval. So, for example, they might ask, how often over the past week have you had thoughts of suicide? And there's been very little research that focuses on parameters of suicide ideation, such as intensity, duration, lability, and none in our adolescents to our knowledge. And clinically, this is important because we observe that the course of suicide ideation can be rather heterogeneous. So it can be labile or it can be chronic. All right, next slide, slide 33. So how we examine the course of suicide ideation is that we use this timeline follow-back methodology, in which we use memorable time points, such as birthday, school vacation, the start and end of school. And we look for change points. And using these time points as anchors, weekly ratings were assigned to each week of the six-month follow-up interval. And suicide ideation was rated on a six-point scale with higher scores indicating higher suicide ideation. And we assessed suicide ideation in person at baseline and over the phone at 2 and 4 months post-discharge, and again in person at 6 months. And intensity was operationalized by averaging the PSR scores across all follow-up weeks. So higher scores would indicate higher intensity. Now, suicide ideation lability was operationalized in two ways. One involved using a statistical procedure called the mean square successive differences, which captures the degree that scores change week to week over follow-up. And the other was just a simple count of the number of switches to and from the clinically significant suicide ideation range. Since our results using both methods were comparable, we mainly present the results from the mean squared successive differences here. Move on to the next slide, 34. So here we have a graphical depiction of the suicide ideation PSR scores over the follow-up interval. And we see that while the mean score for adolescents with BPD was slightly higher throughout, that there was really no significant difference between groups. And on the next slide, slide 35, we see here that there's no appreciable difference with regard to number of switches to and from the clinically significant suicide ideation range. So in fact, some of the outliers with numerous switches were observed in those without borderline personality disorder. Go on to the next slide. So when we look at the correlations between suicide intensity and lability with other indices of suicide risk, we see that intensity appears to be more correlated with our suicidal outcomes, specifically with the suicide ideation questionnaire at both time points, baseline and follow-up, as well as suicide attempt, NSSI, and suicide events over follow-up. And lability was not significantly correlated with these variables. Next slide. However, we did find that lability does seem to be more strongly correlated with measures of affective reactivity or lability. Let's move on to the next slide. And so we conducted a series of univariate logistic regression models to compare our suicide ideation variables on how well they did in predicting suicide events over follow-up. And we find that intensity was significant in predicting suicide events over follow-up, while ability was not. We then tested a post-hoc multivariate model in an attempt to make sense of somewhat contradictory findings, in which, on one hand, borderline personality disorder was not significantly correlated with any of the suicide ideation parameters or measures, but it was significantly associated with suicide attempt history, and it trended towards significantly predicting suicide events. And we also know that in this highly acute sample, in which all the patients were suicidal, that affective dysregulation was quite common and didn't really distinguish those with and without BPD, but what did distinguish was behavioral dysregulation. So we tested a model with lability, behavioral dysregulation, and the interaction of these variables, and found that while there was no main effect of lability, behavioral dysregulation was significant in predicting suicide events, and the interaction of these two variables trended towards a significance, which suggests that lability in and of itself may not be associated with increased suicide risk. But when it's combined with behavioral dysregulation, then it becomes much more concerning. Let's go on to the next set of slides. So to summarize that last set of questions, well, in a sample of inpatient adolescents admitted to suicide due to suicide risk, a BPD diagnosis was largely unrelated to suicide ideation intensity and lability. It's possible that this might be due to the restricted severity range in our sample, in which they were all, acutely suicidal. We found that suicide ideation intensity is more clearly associated with prospectively observed suicide attempts and suicide events than lability. Lability was unrelated to other measures of suicide ideation, but it was related to negative affect intensity and reactivity, which shows that there's some validity to this as a construct, but it's much more related to affective lability. And this lability paradox may be explained by higher behavioral regulation, dysregulation in borderline personality disorder, which when combined with lability has a trend towards predicting suicide events. So moving on to slide 40, and this is our final set of questions. Does perceived emotion invalidation from family or peers predict suicide behaviors or NSSI? On slide 41, we use Marshall Linehan's definition of emotional invalidation, which is an intolerance toward the expression of private emotional experiences. And it's a key ideologic component in her biosocial theory of borderline personality disorder. Now, in fact, most prevailing theories of suicide have a social belongingness perspective, dating back to Durkheim's theory of suicide, and also Joyner's interpersonal theory, which I had mentioned earlier. And while related constructs have been examined in relation to risk for suicidal behavior, such as social support, no study to our knowledge has examined perceived family and peer invalidation as prospective predictors of suicidal behavior in NSSI. So let's move on to the next slide. So again, we use the same timeline follow-back methodology that I described earlier to assess course of perceived peer invalidation and perceived family invalidation. And ratings of 4 to 6 indicated high invalidation, and ratings from 1 to 3 indicated absent or minimal invalidation. Let's move on to the next slide, slide 43. So this table looks at perceived invalidation predicting suicide events. Now the numbers you see are percentages within each group noted in the column headers that experience moderate to high perceived invalidation from family and peers, respectively. So in the first set of percentages, the first couple of lines of percentages, those are for invalidation reported at baseline, and the second set of percentages are for invalidation reported at follow-up. Now, I want to draw your attention to the bold font. Here we see that perceived family invalidation significantly predicted suicide events in boys only, and this held true for both baseline and follow-up ratings. Now, girls reported higher overall rates of invalidation, but this wasn't significantly different from those who, between those who made a suicide attempt over follow-up and those who didn't. Now, this difference was only observed in boys and only for perceived family invalidation. And it remained significant after controlling for multiple other factors which were previously identified as predicting suicide events in our sample, such as low positive affect, aggression, childhood trauma, and some demographic variables. Let's move on to slide 44. Here we have perceived invalidation predicting NSSI over follow-up. And we see here that perceived invalidation from peers significantly predicts NSSI in both boys and girls. And this is true for both baseline and follow-up ratings of invalidation. And again, here we also control for a number of significant covariates. So this is a robust finding. Let's go on to the next slide. So to summarize this last set of questions, we found that a high proportion of adolescents, over 50%, had feelings of perceived invalidation from family and peers at baseline that persisted through a significant proportion of the follow-up interval. And that perceived family invalidation predicted suicide events in boys only. Possible that perceived family invalidation, which is more intractable, leads to hopelessness and despair, which might lead to suicide attempts or events.
So do you have any ideas for why you saw this sex difference, why this was found in boys only and not girls?
Well, this is purely based on my speculation. But I think that it might relate to sexual identification and gender expression, that, you know, the truth is that this time in our society, I think gender expression for girls is more expansive and accepted than gender expression in boys. So, I believe that, I can think of few specific cases in which we suspected that this was something underlying our the suicidality, that, you know, in many families, if a girl chooses to express herself, or, you know, whether through mannerisms or appearance, much more like a boy, like a classic tomboy, that generally was more acceptable to families and possibly society than a boy choosing to express gender that was more feminine. And it's likely that that disparity, not surprisingly, would lead to more experiences of invalidation, particularly from the family. So that's my best guess as to why we found this in boys and not girls.
And again, why you're seeing the sex difference. Right, and
right.
Just one idea for why you're seeing the sex difference from family invalidation, but not the peers.
Exactly. And again, unfortunately, we didn't collect that data. I wish that we had collected data on gender expression, and which we are doing for subsequent studies. But that's just based on what I observed in clinically in our sample. On the other hand, perceived peer invalidation predicted NSSI in boys and girls. So it's possible that peer environments are potentially more modifiable. So, for example, a girl can a child can always change their school, which often, you know, we see happen when bullying becomes intolerable. Such that perceived peer invalidation may prompt behaviors of escape or distraction. Let's move on to slide number 46. So with regard to conclusions and clinical takeaways, first, there's compelling evidence that borderline personality disorder leads to increased risk for suicidal behaviors, although the weight of evidence is not as strong in adolescents compared to adults. However, per the interpersonal psychological theory, this may be because borderline personality disorder adolescents are in the process of acquiring the capacity to self-harm, which would result in higher risk for suicide and suicidal behaviors in adulthood. And when adolescents with BPD do make attempts, the intent and medical threat are comparable in severity to those without BPD. So they need to be taken very seriously. Also, behavior dysregulation seems to be the distinguishing characteristic in borderline personality disorder suicidal adolescents. And despite affective lability, the suicide ideation in adolescents with BPD is not characterized by lability. And we also found that intensity of suicide ideation was more predictive of suicidal behaviors than lability of suicide ideation. And finally, perceived invalidation is common in suicidal adolescents, and family invalidation seems to predict suicide events in boys, while peer invalidation predicts NSI in boys and girls. And so that's it for conclusions. On my final slide, I really want to acknowledge my mentors, my collaborators, study participants and their families, and the funding agency. These studies were all based on my Career Development Award, which was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. And so I'll stop here, and I'm happy to take
some
questions.
Thank you so much, Shirley. That was a fabulous presentation, and a little less than 10 minutes. I want to make sure we get to ask questions from our listeners. So we have one from a caller who had said that they have been treating teens doing treatment with teens using dialectical behavior therapy for over 20 years. And this caller mentioned that he or she sees a great reluctance to diagnose BPD in this age range and asked if you have any other strategies to counter the argument that it's harmful to diagnose teens with BPD?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that I definitely can understand that reluctance, and I see it myself on the inpatient unit that I work on. But I think a couple of things to counter that is psychoeducation about the course of BPD, that actually the prognosis is good if you can get them the right intervention. Second, in my experience, those with BPD and their parents, when they actually get the diagnosis, they actually feel a sense of relief that, hey, this makes sense. So while it can be uncomfortable and uncertain to broach this with families, in some cases, the families do embrace it, and most importantly, I think it helps guide treatment. So, for example, the disorder that is often, I think, confused with BPD or misdiagnosed BPD is bipolar disorder. Well, the treatment indications are somewhat different. So, in bipolar disorder, it's very important to manage with mood stabilizers, lithium, and other anti-manic agents. And, it's also important to get psychosocial intervention, but in treatment of BPD, we see that the most important agent is really psychosocial intervention. So I think it's important to also be open-minded in order for them to get the best treatment possible, the treatment that fits their clinical profile. That being said, I think that it would not surprise me that some families are reluctant to come to accept that diagnosis. And if that's the case, I would not push it. I would focus on the fact that, well, okay, we may not know about this diagnosis, and it could be early. However, your child has affective dysregulation, behavioral dysregulation, and some interpersonal difficulties. And it's these three clusters which does overlap with BPD. So I think that the intervention that is best suited for your child, regardless of diagnosis, might be this dialectic behavior therapy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. So another question we got the caller asks, what are steps that parents should take to help children with negative views and suicidal ideation? And I'm going to ask you to answer this both from your research and feel free to kind of take a step back and answer it from the field at large, too.
So what are the guys? Yes. So I think it's, in terms of helping parents, first of all, it is a very, very difficult thing for, you know, speaking as a parent, to see your child suffer. So I do think that engaging your child in treatment is a very important step. Staying connected is also very important. Keep the lines of communication open. I think this can be very difficult. You know, it's striking a balance between not being overly alarmed but not being complacent. But my data and my clinical experience suggests that, you know, we don't want to become habituated to chronic high levels of negative affect, because, you know, that individual is in real pain. And, you know, my data suggests that that is associated with a higher risk profile. So I think it is important to stay engaged and not get complacent. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the other thing that I might recommend, regardless of diagnosis, is, you know, don't be afraid to talk about suicide. I think a lot of people are hesitant to ask the question because they're afraid that, well, I don't want to put any ideas. Well, if someone's thinking about it, you know, your mentioning or asking about suicide thoughts is not going to tip the balance. And there is research to demonstrate that asking about suicide does not increase suicide risk. So stay engaged, keep asking about it, make sure that they have a therapist that they like, don't get complacent, and I would also leverage technology. So there are a lot of apps out there that can, you know, in which you can make a safety plan on your phone, online, and so they have that at their disposal, because, you know, everybody has their phone with them.
Mm-hmm.
There are apps that can help with mood monitoring, and it would be ideal if, you know, the clinician could have access to that. So I think, you know, for teens, try to leverage technology as well.
And talking about asking about suicidal ideation, you had that finding in your second to last section that SI intensity, not lability, predicted suicidal behaviors. So do you think that tells us anything about how to ask about suicide, or are those findings too preliminary to speak to?
Well, I think that, you know, that finding is most critical for, I think, you know, clinicians. But in terms mm-hmm. of how to ask about it, I think that, you know, asking. So, you know, if someone is at high risk at that moment, then it really doesn't matter so much whether, you know, they were necessarily labile or at high risk, you know, in the preceding week. I think it's helpful to have a bigger picture for a clinician who sees a lot of patients and, you know, and you know, to get a better sense of their client. I think certainly as a parent and a clinician, at any point that they're, you know, a patient expressing high ideation, you know, we certainly have to respond to that. I think that if you know that someone has a more labile profile, then I think, again, it's similar to what I was talking to about earlier. I think that it suggests that their suicide ideation is much more reactive to life events. And so perhaps the strategy there is, let's talk about what just happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's a chain analysis, what coping strategies can you use right now, and such. One can also use that with someone who is, you know, more chronically suicidal. But I think that those strategies may not certainly be sufficient, because that's an individual who is experiencing this, you know, for long periods
mm-hmm.
and,
mm-hmm.
You know, pretty much chronically. So, you know, in that case, different strategies might be involved. I remember having a patient who said to me, you know, look, you know, I have this, this is how I feel. This has always been how I feel because it's sort of the wild card that I carry in my back pocket. And in that case, the strategy may not be coping skills, but trying to challenge the effectiveness of having just chronic suicide ideation as their way of coping and, you know, possible escape from their emotions.
Thank you, Shirley. You make so many excellent points. We're right at 9 o'clock, so we should end it. But thank you to Dr. Shirley Yan for donating your time and sharing your important findings with us. Thanks to everyone who listened in, either live or on our website. And if this is live, you know, I just want to put a plug in to ask folks to call in next week, December 10th, when Dr. Emily Cooney will be hosting our next call with Dr. Andrew Chanin, and he'll be talking to us about early intervention for BPD and overdue reform. So thanks to everyone, and thank you so much, Shirley.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Great. Good night, everyone.
Thank you. It was wonderful. Thank you. Good night.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye. Good night.